This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about a recent court victory challenging the mysterious detention of inmates.
They're at CMU's Communication Management Units, and they have no communication with the outside world.
We'll talk about financial regulations failed. The crooks go unpunished.
They've brought down this economy, caused trillions of dollars in losses, and put 10 million people on the streets unemployed.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, last week there was slightly positive news in the Bradley Manning case. The Pentagon announced that it was going to transfer Bradley Manning to a medium security facility at an Army prison at Fort Leavenworth.
That was a victory. And I think it came about because the United Nations investigator on torture wanted to go see Manning. And a week and a half after he announced that he wanted to go see Manning, they transferred him from Quantico, Virginia, where he was in a Marine brig for many months.
And 10 months.
10 months. Mm. Matt Quantico is only supposed to be for a couple of months before trial. In any case, with the spotlight of the United Nations on the Pentagon and on the Marine Corps, they transferred him to a medium security facility, Fort Leavenworth in Kansas.
Michael, I do agree that could have been the catalyst for this move. I also believe that the mounting public demonstrations, you know, really the people's movement to draw attention to Bradley Manning's plight has helped. And I think once again, this is an example of how when the government remains stalwart in not meeting out justice, it is really incumbent on the people to take it to the streets.
Absolutely. That's what did it. Because remember, they truly were torturing this person, sleep deprivation, keeping him naked, keeping him isolated, all with the intent on breaking him so that he would finger Julian Assange and they could try to get Julian Assange over here for trial. Well, it didn't work. I think if they didn't break him in Quantico, they're not going to be able to do it at Leavenworth either. They'll be able to try him and undoubtedly sentence him to a long prison sentence. They may not be able to establish that link between him and WikiLeaks.
Michael, we had another victory last week, this time not of national import per se, but in New York State. We recently have done some pieces on the housing situation, the rise of homelessness in New York City. And apparently there had been rumors coming from Albany that they were going to lessen the protections afforded to tenants in New York State.
Which would have resulted in many evictions, as Patrick Marquis told us when we interviewed him a month ago. He's the head of policy planning for the Coalition for the Homeless. And he said if they were able to get away with taking these rent stabilization, rent control laws, further weakening them, there would have been many, many more homeless people. So it was a victory in the New York State legislature.
Michael, as if it weren't enough that state troopers are searching and taking information from cell phones, something else is happening truly disturbing in terms of local government.
Yeah, I'll say. I had an email from a friend of mine from Michigan under the subject line, "Fascism comes in with a whimper, not a bang," and then described to me this story that's now unfolding in Benton Harbor, Michigan, this small African-American community in the southwestern corner of the state, where the state has actually taken over the local government. They've got this emergency financial manager who was given increased powers by the state legislature and the Republican Governor Rick Snyder. So now the emergency financial manager, let's call him the EFM, can come in, disregard union contracts, sell land and other properties, and totally take over from what had been a democratically elected government in the city of Benton Harbor, Michigan.
I understand this person can even fire the municipality's government.
Yeah.
I think the national and larger repercussions are very troubling.
Yeah, it's disturbing on another level, too, in that this is a largely African-American community, a poor community, and this has been their first target. Is this going to spread to other cities in Michigan? Is it going to spread to other states in the country? We don't know, but that's why we wanted to call this out.
Michael, I think you may know that the American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan actually filed 13 Freedom of Information Act requests to try to get records about the first kind of emergency financial manager law that had been passed. Their requests are trying to get to the heart of the intent of the law, the scope of authority and oversight, as well as the implications for cities and school districts that currently employ financial managers, and the involvement of the Mackinac Center for Public Policy in drafting the legislation.
I think that they're doing this because when the constitutionality of a law is challenged, you can go to legislative intent. But you've got to first find out what that intent was, and they're doing their homework here.
So we took a few minutes to speak with Zanab Akbar, a guild member and also a legal fellow at the ACLU of Michigan. She wrote one of the ACLU FOIA requests. Let's see what she had to say about this. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
The state of Michigan has done something in Benton Harbor, this small, almost all-black town in the southwest of Michigan. And they've done something that strikes me as extremely alarming. They've got an emergency financial manager under this new law that was passed by the Republican legislature and signed by the Republican governor, Rick Snyder. They've got this emergency financial manager that can dissolve contracts, dissolve unions, totally take over the running of a town as against the elected officials that might have been put in office by the electorate just a few weeks before. What's going on here?
Well, I think Benton Harbor has had an emergency financial manager for some time now. It's a city that's faced some serious financial difficulties, like many communities and school districts in Michigan. The difference now, since the bill passed recently, is that that financial manager can sell public land, as you said, can cancel contracts, and can sell other assets and remove elected officials basically in their sole discretion.
Is there any precedent for this kind of legislation?
I'm not actually sure. I mean, we've had a law in Michigan since 1990 that allowed emergency financial managers to take over the governance of communities that were in financial distress or school districts, but they definitely did not have these kind of powers that they do now.
What's been the reaction of the Michigan trade union movement to what's been done here?
There have definitely been a lot of protests in Lansing. The general retirement system of the city of Detroit and the police and fire retirement system of the city of Detroit filed a lawsuit against Governor Snyder and the treasurer here in Michigan, alleging that parts of the law are unconstitutional.
And on what basis are they saying that it's unconstitutional?
The government should not be able to just, you know, without any process and in their sole discretion, remove elected officials or cancel contracts that were negotiated by elected officials.
I understand that the American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan filed 13 Freedom of Information Act requests seeking records regarding the first kind of emergency financial manager law that was passed.
We filed them and, you know, our concern was that there was very little public discussion on the part of elected officials when the bill passed. And we've only really heard generalities coming out of the executive office here in Michigan. So we don't know a lot about what it went into drafting the law or how the financial managers will be vetted or selected or trained or supervised or compensated. And we don't know the exact contours of their authority either. And, you know, we just want to get a better sense of how this all is going to work. Especially because they have such broad powers, and we want to make sure that the civil liberties and civil rights of Michiganders are protected.
We just heard from Zanab Akbar, legal fellow at the ACLU of Michigan. Last month, the Center for Constitutional Rights won the right for certain prisoners to challenge a violation of their constitutional rights. Inmates at two experimental federal prison units called Communications Management Units, or CMUs, will have their claims heard in court. About 70% of CMU inmates are Muslim men. Some are also environmental and animal rights activists. The judge in the case agreed that the prisoners raised serious constitutional questions about the CMUs. The Center for Constitutional Rights filed the case, Aref v. Holder, in the D.C. District Court on behalf of current and former prisoners of the units in Terre Haute, Indiana, and Marion, Illinois. Two other plaintiffs are the spouses of those prisoners. As listeners may recall, these CMUs were secretly opened under the Bush administration in 2006 and 2007. They were designed to monitor and to control the communications of certain inmates and to isolate them from other prisoners and the outside world. The five plaintiffs in RF were designated to the two CMUs despite having relatively or totally clean disciplinary histories. And none of them have received any communication-related disciplinary infractions in the last decade. In addition to heavily restricted phone and visitation access, CMU inmates are categorically denied any physical contact with family members and are forbidden from hugging, touching, or embracing their children or spouses during visits. To talk more about this case, we're joined now by CCR attorney Alexi Agathakleios. Alexi, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, the Center for Constitutional Rights had a recent victory in your communications management unit suit. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Absolutely. Last year in April, CCR filed a lawsuit on behalf of five prisoners and two of those prisoners' spouses, challenging policies and conditions at two federal prison units. These units are called communications management units. They were opened under the Bush administration. The first at Terre Haute was opened in 2006, and then the second at Marion in Illinois was opened in 2008. These units have been on our radar screen for quite some time. We're very troubled about policies and conditions at these units. So we filed a lawsuit representing five of the prisoners. And last summer, the government moved to dismiss the case. And just last week, we learned that the judge had ruled that our case can proceed. So obviously, we're very happy.
Excellent.
Now, the premise, as I understand it, behind the units is to monitor more carefully and control certain inmates who I guess are deemed more dangerous?
That's right. These units are designed to isolate certain individuals who the BOP claims require heightened communications monitoring. But this raises a number of problems. A number of the restrictions that are imposed at the CMUs are severe, they're permanent, and they're unparalleled elsewhere in the federal prison system. And what they're doing is they are truly cutting people off from their family, from their loved ones, from the community and the outside world needlessly.
What restrictions are those? Can you enumerate them? For example,
sure.
I'm troubled by the fact that they can't even hug or embrace their children if they get a visit. I mean, what are these restrictions and what's the purpose of them?
That's right. So, for example, as you said, that there's a blanket ban on contact visits, and this is absolutely unparalleled in the federal prison system. There is no single other unit anywhere, including Supermax, that imposes a permanent ban on any physical contact with visitors. The CMUs also quite severely restrict access to visits in terms of duration and frequency. And they also severely limit phone calls, both in terms of duration and frequency. So what we're seeing here is truly an effort on the BOP's part to cut people off from the outside world. And we believe that this needlessly impinges on their right to family integrity and their need to maintain these ties to the outside world. The BOP recognizes as a matter of policy that it must cultivate a prisoner's ability to maintain ties with their family and with the community. Number one, that helps with institutional adjustment. And number two, that is the single best predictor of prisoners' ability to reintegrate into society upon release. And you see that policy turned on its head at the CMUs. Now, the BOP says it needs to be able to monitor these individuals' communications, and we don't actually challenge that. What we are challenging is the fact that the particular restrictions that are imposed don't seem to achieve those goals. And second of all, what's very troubling is the fact that there is no due process attached to designation to these units. Other control units within the federal prison system come with notice. They come with an opportunity to contest your placement in a control unit.
Now, Alexi, does that mean you can just be transferred from one prison to this prison?
Absolutely.
And without any process? You can just, one day you wake up, I'll see you at the CMU.
That's what's happened to every single one of our clients. They have been sent to the CMU, and only when they get there do they receive a piece of paper explaining that they have been designated to this unit without any meaningful explanation of why, without any disclosure of the factual allegations that were used to designate them, without a demonstration of past abuse of communication devices, without a hearing, without an appeal. And once you're at the CMU, there's also no meaningful review process. So no one is told what they would need to do to earn their transfer out, and no one is told, how decisions are made about keeping someone at CMU indefinitely or transferring them back into general population.
One little fact. We covered this a while ago, not in brief, of the CMUs. And at that point, we looked at them as really Muslim control units. And is that, and when you talked about it so far, you haven't really addressed that issue. But what's the story on that?
Well, that is still very much the case and still one of the principal issues in this lawsuit. So what we do know is that at this stage, somewhere between 65 and 72% of the population of the CMUs is Muslim. Now, this is compared to a 6% national average.
It certainly doesn't reflect the country.
Right, no, this is a tenfold overrepresentation of Muslim prisoners at the CMUs. Some of this population has been convicted of crimes such as material support, but some have convictions entirely unrelated to terrorism. And they've been flagged as posing a danger of recruitment and radicalization without any substantiation of those allegations, without any sense of what someone has done to sort of have them put in this category. And because there is no process, the prisoner has no ability to understand these allegations, to contest them, and to appeal the decision to designate them to the CMU as a result of them. So what we think is happening, when you look to our clients, you know, our clients have benign and in some cases perfectly clean disciplinary history. So, for example, Yassine Aref has a single disciplinary infraction from his entire time in the BOP, and that was for taking a candy bar to prayer with him. That is single disciplinary infraction, and yet he finds himself at the CMU.
Amazing.
So our contention is that what is happening is people are being designated there, Muslim prisoners are being designated there based on the discriminatory belief that as Muslims, they inherently pose a greater danger to institutional security than do other prisoners.
Alexei, some people believe that some of the animal rights and environmental activists who've also been housed in the CMUs are being put there to send a very strong message to other activists that this may happen to them if they continue to be vocal.
Yeah, we are very concerned also about a pattern of designation of political prisoners. And as you said, that specifically includes environmental and animal rights activists. So one of our clients, Daniel McGowan, for example, was convicted of crimes related to his environmental activism, and though he too has no disciplinary infractions whatsoever, and necessarily therefore no infractions related to using the phone, abusing visits, or anything of that nature, he too was abruptly designated to the CMU. Now, Daniel was actually released into general population several months back, but then just a few weeks ago was sent back to the CMU without any meaningful explanation once again. So two things. One is that we do believe that these are acts of retaliation for protected First Amendment activity, such as speaking out on social justice issues, for advocating around prisoners' rights issues, and where our clients have advocated for themselves as individual prisoners, we see them suddenly and abruptly designated to the CMUs. I agree that this also sort of serves as a deterrent to being outspoken and to being politically engaged within the prison system, and that is deeply troubling. And then also, we have heard reports that the units were almost entirely Muslim at their inception. And we have heard reports that some of the political activists who were transferred in were referred to as balancers in order to sort of answer questions about why these units were almost exclusively Muslim. So there seemed to be a confluence of factors going on.
Tell us what kind of relief you would hope to win in the case.
What we've asked for in the case is for a thorough review of policies and practices of the CMU. We are arguing that the BOP needs to bring conditions at the CMUs in line with other prison facilities throughout the federal system, or close down the CMUs. We're also arguing that proper procedures need to be in place if the BOP is to sustain and maintain the CMUs. Proper procedures need to be put in place that give people proper notice about why they've been designated, proper series of allegations so that they can meaningfully contest them, and the right to appeal and the right to a hearing. Because without those, what we're seeing is this pattern of discriminatory and retaliatory designations, and that's just unacceptable.
Alexei, I mean, we have you on today in particular because you guys just won a motion to dismiss the lawsuit, and that's quite extraordinary in a prison lawsuit to begin with, and one particularly around this communications management unit. Can you tell us what that means and what the next steps are?
Sure. So the court is allowing the case to proceed on two of our claims. First of all, our procedural due process claim, and second of all, our claim of retaliation, which is basically a claim that a number of our clients were designated to the CMUs in retaliation for protected First Amendment activity. Unfortunately, the court did dismiss the remainder of our claims. So, for example, we brought an equal protection claim arguing that the massive overrepresentation of Muslim prisoners violated the Equal Protection Clause under the federal constitution. So as I said, unfortunately, the standards for those kinds of claims are extremely exacting. We are not being allowed to proceed on those claims. So we're disappointed about that. But ultimately, we are extremely pleased about this ruling because the procedural due process point that we are proceeding on really gets to the heart of this case. It really gets to the heart of the matter. And that's because the lack of oversight, the absolute impunity with which BOP has been allowed to designate to these prisoners to the CMUs is what has resulted in this retaliation and this discrimination. So we can really still get to the heart of those issues through these claims. So what's next is we're going into discovery, which is obviously our opportunity to learn a lot more about the CMUs, about their inception, about who was involved in designing them and why, and about how decisions were made about designating prisoners to the CMUs. The CMUs have really been shrouded in a lot of secrecy for a number of years now. They were opened very, very quietly without proper opportunity for notice and comment. And so this really will be our first opportunity to really get behind these units and understand what's going on there. There's one sort of interesting phenomenon that I think is important to note, and it's something you alluded to earlier about the sort of confluence of Muslim prisoners and environmental activists at the CMUs. As I've said, the CMUs are predominantly used to isolate Muslim prisoners, both those convicted under this radically overbroad material support statute, and those who are not, based on discriminatory rationales. And I think there's been a fair amount of attention to the remarkable sweep of the material support law, most particularly after the Supreme Court's decision in Humanitarian Law Project versus Holder. That case obviously held that even pure speech advocating peaceful resolution to conflict can be deemed as material support for terrorism. But I think there's also been a less obvious pattern of isolating individuals caught up in what's called the green scare at the CMUs. And I think it's important to draw that connection. There's a very serious campaign on the federal level to silence and intimidate both animal rights and environmental activists. The FBI has labeled so-called eco-terrorists as the number one domestic terrorist threat. And I think this successful mobilization of the term terrorist, both in the context of the material support law and the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which is a federal statute that's used to prosecute environmental activists, has basically given politicians cover for passing extremely repressive legislation that is intended to intimidate and silence environmental activists. So I think those are two laws that are overbroad. They're used to label individuals who don't engage in violence as terrorists, not just criminals, but terrorists. And both statutes just sweep in extraordinary amounts of conduct. And this is being used to justify isolating people in these enormously restrictive conditions, without due process, without disclosure of why or for how long. And irrespective of the fact that these policies needlessly destroy family relationships and invaluable connections to the outside world. So that, I think, is an important conversation that needs to be part of our response to the CMU.
What's the website you can go to for information about the CMU case?
Your listeners can go to www.ccrjustice.org/CMU. And that will give you access to the papers that have been filed in the case, a fact sheet about the CMUs, and also links to advocacy opportunities around the CMUs as well.
Well, thanks, Alexia.
Thanks, Alexia.
And congratulations. A great victory.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Last week, the Securities and Exchange Commission charged Goldman Sachs and Company and one of its executives with fraud in a risky offshore deal backed by subprime mortgages that cost its investors more than $1 billion. The SEC also contends that Goldman allowed a client, Wall Street hedge fund Paulson and Company, to help select the securities to be sold. Paulson, in turn, bought insurance against the deal, and when the securities sank, losing nearly all value, Paulson then made a $1 billion profit. While these are not criminal charges, the recently released 650-page report of the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, Wall Street and the Financial Crisis, had exposed the deceptive and risky practices within major financial institutions that deceived clients and the public. We're joined today by Professor William K. Black, author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He's a professor of law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, who has criticized the absence of any criminal referrals or national task force to effectively punish the elite fraudsters. He teaches white-collar crime, public finance, antitrust, and law and economics. Welcome, Professor Black, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
There have been no criminal indictments since the subprime mortgage crisis. Can you tell our listeners why that is?
Well, there have been indictments, but they've been indictments of little people, the tiny frauds. So the FBI, in its most recent report, was proud that 60% of its mortgage fraud cases now involved $1 million or more. Of course, that's two California houses and such. But just yesterday, we had the first conviction in a trial of a senior official. And now, unfortunately, the fraud didn't really relate to the underlying mortgage fraud. It's a special case where the people in charge of a mortgage banking firm tried to rip off the TARP program and were caught apparently by the Inspector General. Some of your listeners may be familiar with the work of Mr. Borowski. He's been very tough as SIGTARP and unfortunately just resigned. But we owe these prosecutions to his vigor.
Bill, explain to our listeners how the subprime mortgage disaster came about, and then how people that profited by it were let slide.
Yeah, that's an excellent intro, because many people still call it the subprime crisis. It would be far better to call it the liar's loan crisis, because it turns out our best information, and it's not perfect by any means, is that roughly half of all subprime loans by 2006 were liar's loans. And, of course, liar's loans were liar's loans on top of that. Somewhere between a quarter and maybe as much as 49% of new home loans were in the form of liar's loans. And the incidence of fraud, when there have been independent studies, has ranged from 90 to 100% on liar's loans. So what is a liar's loan? A liar's loan is when there's no underwriting. That means no verification of what's put into the loan application. And most people, when they hear it, they assume that the liar must be the borrower, right? They must fill out the application. They must lie about their income so that they can get a better interest rate or a larger loan. And that happens sometimes. But what we know is that overwhelmingly, it was the lenders that put the lie in liar's loans.
Well, explain why that they were able to securitize, bunch up these loans, and then sell them. And that was the incentive, wasn't it, for them to lie about them?
That's correct. You could sell these loans for more money in what we call the secondary market if they appeared to have two characteristics that finance tells us you can't have simultaneously. And that was a premium interest rate, which we call yield, and simultaneously low risk, right? So you're not supposed to be able to charge a premium interest rate for low-risk stuff. But if you could make it appear that it was low-risk and you could charge less sophisticated borrowers, less financially sophisticated borrowers, a premium rate, you could have the best of all worlds. And the way to do that was to gimmick two ratios. One ratio was debt to income. So that means, how much are you borrowing compared to what your annual income is? And if your income is bigger, then, of course, it sounds safer to borrow $200,000 if you're making $150,000 a year, for example. So the way to gimmick that ratio is to inflate the income. The second ratio is the loan-to-value ratio. The loan is just the amount of the mortgage loan. And the value is, what is the appraised value of the house? Well, the way to inflate that was to inflate the appraisal. And that's a good place to start really focusing. Because here's one of the great truths, and it's one of the great truths being ignored by the Justice Department right now, and of course covered up by the industry. And it is, an honest, secured lender would never inflate or permit to be inflated appraisal values. Because, of course, the security property is their great protection against loss. But it makes perfect sense for a fraudulent lender to want to inflate the appraised value of the house so they can sell the loan on the secondary market for a higher profit. And now think about, can a borrower get the appraiser to inflate the appraised value? No, you typically don't pick them at all. You don't even know who they are. But the lenders pick the appraisers or the lender's agents. And they create what we call a Gresham's dynamic. And that means that bad ethics drives good ethics out of the marketplace. Then Attorney General Cuomo, now governor, did an investigation and found that this was a common practice, but explicitly he found it at Washington Mutual, which is the largest bank failure in U.S. history. He found that WaMu had a blacklist of appraisers, but you got on the blacklist if you refused to inflate the appraised value. Again, no honest lender would ever do that. And Cuomo said he would have indicted them if he had jurisdiction. Well, so there's your question. The guy who ran WaMu left incredibly wealthy.
Who's the guy and how much did he steal?
Well, he got well over $100 million, and his name's Killinger. None of these people are being prosecuted.
Why not? If WaMu was clearly engaged in this unlawful practice.
Here are the two great truths of investigation of sophisticated financial frauds when they're occurring in epidemic amounts. And by the way, that's not my word. That's what the FBI testified in front of the House of Representatives in September 2004. Note that date, 2004, for the next time somebody tells you, oh, nobody could see this coming. The FBI testified that there was an epidemic of mortgage fraud and predicted that it would cause a financial crisis, again, their words, if it were not stopped. Well, obviously, it wasn't stopped at all. So what's different? In the savings and loan crisis, which was dramatically smaller than this crisis, in part because of what we did to take the frauds out of leadership positions, we got over 1,000 felony convictions in what the FBI labels major cases. So these are not the little guys. And indeed, that understates it, because we worked with the FBI in a very formal process to create the top 100 priority list, and that was mostly institutions. So that actually translated into about 700 individuals. And so a very good chunk of those 1,000 felony convictions of elites were the worst of the worst, the most senior executives leading the frauds. To do that, our regulatory agency made well over 10,000 criminal referrals. And we did a host of other things, but mostly it was because we had two dominant priorities. Our first priority was to get rid of the frauds, to close them down, put them in receivership, remove those CEOs from where they could cause further damage. And our second agency priority was, once we had done that, to help the Justice Department put those people in prison.
We're speaking with Professor Bill Black, who is a law professor, specializes in white-collar crime. Let's fast forward to the current and gigantic subprime mortgage disaster. How much money was involved in this? And then the real question is, why haven't the indictments flowed like they did in the earlier savings and loan disaster?
So in terms of magnitude, the savings and loan debacle cost about $150 billion. The current crisis is costing well over $10 trillion.
Whoa.
A trillion is 1,000 billion.
Wow.
Whoa.
Right? So this is immensely greater crisis. This is a crisis that cost well over 10 million Americans their jobs and such. This is the crisis that actually caused the great bulk of this deficit that you have all this hysteria about right now on the right and such. Right? In the current crisis, our agency, the one I used to work for, the Office of Thrift Supervision, which again made well over 10,000 criminal referrals in that much smaller savings and loan crisis, made zero criminal referrals.
It's hard to wrap your mind around that. I mean, why?
Well, because the iconic image, and I realize on radio this doesn't work so well, but perhaps you can put it on your web as well, should be something they were so proud of, they actually put it into the FDIC's annual report, I think for 2002. And it's a picture of Chainsaw Gillerin. That was the head of the Office of Thrift Supervision, the entity that made zero criminal referrals. He's holding a chainsaw. He's standing next to the three leading bank lobbyists in America. They're holding pruning shears. And the deputy head of the FDIC, who will become Gillerin's successor as head of the Office of Thrift Supervision, is also holding pruning shears. They are posed and poised over a pile of federal regulations to demonstrate their intention of working at the behest of the industry to destroy regulation. Well, mission accomplished, guys. Instead of being incredibly embarrassed that they were working hand in glove with the lobbyists, they were proud of this and put this in their annual report. They loved this image. And so it comes, you know, the saying is fish rot from the head. And in the Bush administration, the way you got appointed to as a senior regulator was to be the leading opponent of regulation.
Yeah.
And so we have this self-fulfilling prophecy of regulatory failure. Now, in fairness, a lot of this started in the later years of the Clinton administration as well. It actually didn't start, but it was there present as well. They're the ones who passed and squashed Brooks Lyborn when she tried to regulate derivatives, financial derivatives.
Yeah.
And, you know, destroyed, removed her authority to do so completely, deliberately in the Commodities Future Modernization Act of 2000, created two regulatory black holes, one on credit default swaps that helped lead to AIG, and the other was on energy derivatives trading, which helped Enron exploited to create the California energy crisis. So, yeah, you know, Clinton started, ended really bad, but Bush then made it far worse. And the staggering thing about this is that Obama, seeing this disaster, made it his own by taking the folks in Bush's financial world that Tom Frank aptly labeled the wrecking crew and promoting them, right? So he took Geithner, who had been the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and made him our principal financial person. Well, Geithner, we now know from the expose in the New York Times, Louise Story and Gretchen Morgenson's story last week, that he actually intervened, including with Cuomo, to urge that there not be even investigations, much less prosecutions, of the elite financial frauds, because this, he thought that the financial system was too fragile. His idea
really?
Is to restore a financial system by leaving the frauds as CEOs.
Yeah, you know, that's like ending the war by continuing it.
The Justice Department ruined an FBI initiative to try to actually investigate the elite frauds. And this was Attorney General Mukasey under Bush, who refused to create a nationwide task force against the frauds, provided as late as fiscal year 2007 only 120 FBI agents to deal with all of the mortgage frauds nationwide. And in refusing to create any significant force to go after the fraud, said, no, this is just the equivalent of, and I'm quoting him, white-collar street crime.
Stunning.
Now, to give you a contrast,
street.
There were 1,000 FBI agents assigned to working the savings and loan frauds during the debacle. So this is fewer than one-eighth as many FBI agents to deal with a crisis that was somewhere on the order of 40 times bigger than the savings and
so
loan.
So the bad guys learned the lesson, not the good guys.
Yeah, well, that's an excellent point, because, you know, you the saying you always hear is those who fail to learn from the mistakes of the past are condemned to repeat them. But it's far worse to fail to learn from the successes of the past. If you take everything we did, which is good 20 different things, institutional and making priorities, et cetera, and we improved it continuously by getting feedback from the FBI and the Justice Department, you know, our how do we make our criminal referrals better? How do we aid you in the investigations more effectively? And all of that leads to this immense success, the greatest in history, and they do absolutely none of those things in the current crisis. And by the way, never bothered to even talk with the people that created the successes.
I'm curious, Professor, you teach at the University of Missouri. You must have such prime firsthand material now for your classes in white-collar crime, public finance, antitrust, law, and economics. What do your students think of all of this?
They are appalled. We have students from all over, including all over the world. And so a number of our students grew up in nations that are crony capitalism. So, you know, it's not identical to their countries, but this is the American version of crony capitalism, which is, if you are powerful enough, if you have enough ties, if after Citizens United you can make enough political contributions, you will not be prosecuted. Mm-hmm. You will not be removed from office. Your bonuses will be restored within months. And we will bail you out using federal money. And we will do it secretly as much as possible through the Fed windows and such in terms of we'll take really atrocious collateral and give you good money loans. It's hard to imagine a better way to destroy that which has been most successful in America, because you can't have crony capitalism and have democracy either.
Right.
Well, I think that's well said. The fact is that one of the cronies was Obama. There was a lot said about how he got his campaign contributions from the bottom up, $5 and $10 contributions and so on. But when you looked into it closer, a lot of the money came from the kind of people you're talking about who don't want to be regulated. Hedge fund guys who live in Greenwich, Connecticut, banks, Goldman Sachs and so on were some of his biggest supporters. And I think you pointed out that they got the payoff.
This brings us to a couple of broader issues as well that are so destructive. The power reinforces itself, and it keeps itself in power even when it screws up massively. So finance is the leading contributor to both parties, big finance. And big finance is, after all, only supposed to be a middleman. It's supposed to help the real economy by simply allocating most efficiently capital among productive uses. And like any middleman, you want absolutely minimal profits going to the middleman. Instead, the world has been turned upside down, where under some measures, finance has 40% of the total profits of all American businesses. Depending on the time period and how you measure it, some measurements say it only has about 23%. But that's absurd, right? We take the thing that's supposed to be the tail, and we now let it move the entire economy and dominate the entire economy. And that has also massively increased income inequality in America. And you can't have pervasive income inequality in America without leading to an underclass that gets written off and without perpetuating the rule of the elites. And if the elites were competent, that'd be one thing. But what you have to get out of this crisis is they are spectacularly incompetent. And when they're not, they're criminal. So this is the worst group of people you can possibly imagine having power. And they get worse. They get more arrogant. They start talking about how they're doing God's work. They are delusional as well as incompetent. Indeed, a book that came out, unfortunately, bad timing. It was a triumphal story of capitalism. It's called Moral Markets. Even that book says that homo economicus, the people that actually act the way the neoclassical economic models claim people should act, are, and I quote them, sociopaths. So we now have rule by sociopaths, and we've turned too many of our business schools into fraud factories where we train people how to gimmick accounting.
Where do we go from here?
Well, you can fight Citizens United. Citizens United A, of course. This tells you how critical it is in terms of who the president is. As weak as President Obama is on many financial issues, you certainly end up with better Supreme Court people than you would get under any of the Republicans who are running. Citizens United is a fragile case. It doesn't make a lot of sense in terms of the law, and it could be overturned with one change in justices. Even if you can't overturn it, you can change it legislatively by providing much broader public financing where it's actually a good deal. As you know, one of the terrible things about the current system is that then-candidate Obama, and now as President Obama, he's going to opt out of public funding. And he's talked about wanting to raise for his reelection effort $1 billion, or at least his staff has talked about this. Now that's going to come. The only way to get that is to draw heavily on the largest corporations. And again, his fundraising staff is open about that. So you see this retreat from any progressive ideas throughout the realm of finance.
How do you view Obama's relationship with Goldman Sachs and others like them in the upcoming election?
Well, I mean, the relationship between Wall Street and the Rubin wing of the Democratic Party is that they are inseparable. You get Rubens, the supposed guru, who goes to Citicorp, and what these people are engines for destroying wealth. They only get a few billions. They destroy $10 trillion in wealth. They cost 10 million Americans their jobs, and at least another 10 million the ability to work full-time. So the Democratic Party has to choose. Is it going to be the party of Rubin and Goldman Sachs, or is it going to be a party representing the people? The party that represents Goldman Sachs is not good for the economy. It is the gravest threat to the economy. It is dishonest. It is incompetent.
This has been a sobering discussion, and I had wanted to ask earlier if you could just describe a bit about the Office of Thrift Supervision where you used to work.
Well, it depended enormously on its leadership. I'll give you an example. In 1991, California Savings and Loans started to do liar's loans heavily. And we, the Office of Thrift Supervision, West Region, killed it by normal supervisory means. And we didn't think we deserved any great credit for that. After all, how hard is it to figure out that something called a liar's loan is not a good idea? Now, we do that, and what happens? The leading folks doing these worst loans, running Long Beach Savings, voluntarily gives up his federal charter so that he no longer will be regulated by us, forms a mortgage company, which is not subject to our federal regulation. Now, Alan Greenspan could have regulated them because the Fed had unique authority. They refused to use it. And other key people that were, it's called removed and prohibited from the savings and loan industry, went over and became this guy's chief competitors in making liar's loans in the early years. Eventually, 49 state attorney generals sue that CEO, the former CEO of Long Beach Savings, and the Federal Trade Commission. They settle for hundreds of millions of dollars, and then two things happen. First, the head, this disgraced person, we make him our ambassador to the Netherlands because he was Bush's leading contributor. And two, Citicorp and Washington Mutual rushed to acquire his business, which was called AmeriQuest, because after all, they wanted those thousands of employees every day of the year. What did they do? They created predatory loans targeted at minorities, and people whose first language wasn't English, and they engaged in outright fraud, including forging signatures and forging supposed income, creating perjured documents. And two of the largest banks in America said, that's the kind of people we want working for us. The Office of Thrift Supervision, effective in that era.
Right.
In other time periods, we got the head of our agency to resign in disgrace because he removed our jurisdiction over Lincoln Savings. That was Charles Keating, the most notorious fraud in that crisis. So the failure to prosecute, to actually get into bed with the crooks, there was a national scandal. But you don't see those kinds of hearings. Carl Levin came closest, but again, there were no drama and angst of the right kind of questioning there, although, credit to them for issuing a report that people should read about these things. Later, though, we'd also got demoted five levels, the head of the whole Office of Thrift Supervision, because he had recommended giving in to Charles Keating. That person, Daryl Doko, demoted five levels and sent to our most obscure office, which unfortunately was Seattle, Washington, which is where Washington Mutual was. So he rode the supposed success of Washington Mutual because the frauds always report record profits just before they collapse in disaster. And then you had the competition and laxity, because this is now the era with Chainsaw Gillerin that I told you about earlier as the head of the agency, and then Reich as his successor. And so they brought Doko back and promoted him. And they put him in charge of bringing Countrywide, that infamous institution, into the becoming a savings and loan. See, it had been regulated by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which, while weak, was not as weak. And so this is actually called the competition and laxity among regulators. And they liked this competition because they liked laxity in regulation, if you can imagine that. And by the way, I can personally tell you about this. The regulators in this era were instructed to refer to the banks as their clients.
Oh, that's terrible.
Daryl Doko brings Countrywide, already infamous for its frauds, into the savings and loan industry. And for that, he is promoted and put in charge of the entire West region, where he is in charge of regulating Countrywide, Washington Mutual, and IndyMac. Not many people have heard of, but actually the most infamous of the liar's loan specialists and such. And then even the Office of Thrift Supervision has to get rid of him because it comes out that he has knowingly permitted IndyMac to backdate financial statements to make it appear healthier.
Professor William K. Black, it's just a delight to have you on Law & Disorder. Let me ask you, have you written about this or do you plan to write about it? What can we tell our listeners if they want to stay in touch with your clear thinking?
We first, of course, there's a book about the earlier crises by me, and that's The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. I'm writing books currently about the crisis, but we, the University of Missouri at Kansas City Economics Department, and that's, by the way, where my primary appointment is in economics, have a blog, New Economic Perspectives. We have really good stuff. We are one of the rare heterodox economic departments left in the nation. And so you won't get the usual stuff that turned out to be completely false.
Give us that blog again so people can write it down.
New Economic Perspectives. You can just go to the University of Missouri, Kansas City Economics Department and find a link to the blog.
Professor Black, it's really been an honor. It's been a bit depressing, but really one of our top interviews. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Bill.
Bye-bye.
Take it easy.
If you want to hear Law & Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law & Disorder Radio on Facebook.